This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
The Doctor's Lounge is open here on America's Web Radio. This is your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us today. As usual today, class participation is half your grade, so I need to hear from you. The Twitter handle is at capital D numeral 4, all caps PCFDN. Get out your smartphone right now. Write this down. At D numeral 4 PCFDN, all caps, except for the number, of course. So before we get started, well, good morning, David. How you doing over there? David's running the board this morning as usual.
I'm doing fine. Getting, just like I mentioned, every time I start talking and thinking about it, it's blood pressure pill time. And, you know, Obama has done well with keeping our blood pressure up for 6 years now.
Yeah, and I don't expect that to stop anytime soon. So in recognition of recent events, first let me say that today's show has been purged of all unfavorable references to North Korea. Today's revised topic will be Kim Jong-un. What a great guy. And next week's show will be broadcast live from Havana with special guests Fidel and Raul, who will be discussing standards for humane treatment of political prisoners. Sorry, I had to get my cup of sarcasm in every morning. Otherwise, I'm going to be grouchy for the rest of the day. So thank you for indulging me. So welcome. Welcome to the last show of 2014. Next week's Christmas, following week's New Year's, so we will obviously not have shows on those days. We'll all be out of town like you'll be, enjoying the holidays, family and friends. But the following week after New Year's, the 8th of January, we have a very special treat here on the Doctor's Lounge. My always imitated, never duplicated co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, will have Congressman Tom Price on the show as his guest, talking about all of the things related to Obamacare, the Republican alternatives, conservative alternatives to what is already in place, unfortunately. So that show is definitely a must-hear. 8 o'clock in the morning, the 8th of January, 2015, the first show of 2015. The following week, Dr. Hal and I will be together on the show, just like we were the very first time, and we're brainstorming some very interesting ideas, including perhaps doing a 19, well, let's not put a specific decade on it, David. Let's call it a mid-20th century version of the Doctor's Lounge. What were doctors talking about in their Doctor's Lounges 50 years ago? How was medicine different back then than it is today? So we'll be talking about that probably on the 15th of January, and then after that I'll pick up and we'll start taking turns again into the new year of 2015. I had the opportunity to be a patient myself earlier this week. And after having that experience, it has reinforced what I thought for a long time, which is that every doctor ought to be a patient once in a while. Not that I would wish people to be sick, of course, but it's good for doctors once in a while to sort of live through that patient experience and be the one sitting in the waiting room waiting instead of the one people are waiting for. On that particular issue, I'm not exactly known as running on time in my office, so the fact that I had to sit in a waiting room for a while is probably poetic justice.
I thought doctor to doctor, benefits that
some sort of benefits
folks don't get.
Well, not particularly. I mean, yeah, in my office, I mean, sure, physicians who are patients might ask for certain things, but I mean, it's in this day and age, a lot of that you can't do, right? You know, there used to be a thing many years ago where you would, you know, just bill insurance and waive all the patient responsible stuff. That is long, long gone and flagrantly illegal. And every once in a while, I run into an awkward moment there from people who aren't enlightened about such things. But you know, I didn't have any issues with any of that, of course. In fact, I had no issues with the visit whatsoever. I had to wait 30 minutes, after my appointment time. But I didn't care. I brought work with me. It was no big deal. Every time I learned something. This time I think, I have to say that from the patient side, I was fine with the wait. I think we're not cutting hair, I guess is what I'm trying to say, right? I mean, this is not, when I enter an exam room to see a patient who is billed as having a sore throat on the appointment notes or what the triage person got in a brief interview, I don't know, David, whether that person is just going to have a viral infection, right, something relatively mild, self-limited, or if they're going to have throat cancer, or they're going to have something in between. And so I can't predict in advance how long a wait's going to take. I can't walk into somebody and go and examine them and put a scope down their throat and say, well, gosh, I'm concerned that you might have throat cancer. Oh, time's up. You know, your 15-minute slot has expired. I need to see the next patient right on time. You know, that just doesn't work, or at least it doesn't work for me. And when I'm in with a patient, they're going to get everything that they need while they're there, and I don't watch the clock.
Did you hear about your president's little brush with a sore throat in Arizona?
Mm. Yes, I did, David. Yeah.
How many CAT scans have you ordered for sore throats?
That's not unheard of. If it's a routine, plain old sore throat that's, a week or two or 3 weeks old or something like that, a CT scan in those settings would be uncommon. But it's not unheard of. If I treat folks with antibiotics if I think it's an infection, or, drugs and diet changes if I think it's acid reflux, which is the most common thing, and I think from what I read, that's what they suspected he had. But I wouldn't normally get a CT scan.
And bad golf game.
The sore throat and bad golf game? Was that the symptom complex?
Yeah.
Okay, well, CT will surely fix that.
It's just the whole scenario was just, and it had to have cost you and me a couple of shekels.
I'm sure it did, but that's not even their worst. If that was their worst sin, David, we'd be in a whole lot better shape than we
Absolutely
are now.
True.
Those kind of things make me remember when Bill Clinton was president and he had the entire LAX airport tied up and traffic shut down because he wanted a haircut.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Remember that. Yep.
We've had,
Think it was for Hillary, was it?
No, believe it or not, I don't think it was. I think it was for Bill. I think he needed to be, looking good for whatever his next adventure was going to be. So, yeah, you always got to be looking good, I suppose, especially when you're the president. But, getting back to the whole waiting thing and patience thing, I think, you have to give patients the attention they need when they need it. And that's going to, that always causes me to run behind, because even if it's not a dreadful diagnosis like a suspected cancer, a lot of times there are issues that you need to go through to be sure that you get patient buy-in to what it is that you want them to do. What my administrator tells me is that, while, I may have a patient or two here or there that's unhappy with the wait when I walk into the room, nobody's unhappy when I leave. Because they got the time they needed, they got their questions answered. Bottom line is, if you don't budget at least 90 minutes to 2 hours past your appointment time for a doctor visit, you're setting yourself up. Patients who walk into my office and say, well, I have to be somewhere in an hour, or I have to be somewhere in 30 minutes, well, just reschedule. That's not going to fly. So anyhow, there's my rant on waiting, and I only offer it because earlier this week I was the one doing the waiting, and even on that side of the equation, I was fine. I brought work. I was oblivious to the wait. I had a great experience with Dr. Armstrong. He's a great pulmonologist, and hopefully this cough I've got's going to go away sometime soon. So onward to today's topic, right? This is billed as the language barrier between the health information technology community and the physician-provider community, specifically as it relates to the concept of disruptive technology. And some of this is not entirely new to the show, as I've hosted it. In the past, we've talked about the many differences between the health IT community and the medical community. We've talked about how the culture of the health IT community and the culture of the medical community, those two cultures are completely different from each other. We've talked about how the health IT community sees healthcare as a giant machine, and the doctor and the patient are only small cogs in that machine. The data, the patient is merely a thing that generates data. The doctor is merely a device that captures data. And what's important is the data, not what happens between the doctor and the patient. And that health IT paradigm of care is completely different than the doctor's paradigm of healthcare, where the core of what happens involves a doctor, a patient, an exam room, and a conversation and an examination. That is the core of what makes healthcare what it is. It is the core of what makes America the best healthcare system in the world, or used to be the best healthcare system in the world. Hard to tell at this point. But it's completely different models of how the universe is supposed to work between health IT and physicians. So I was reading an article, and quite frankly, I'm not even sure which article it was. It was on some sort of health IT topic. And the topic itself, the material that was in the article, was fairly benign. But as I was reading it, I was getting annoyed. I was getting angry and I was getting annoyed, and I thought, well, this is very strange, because the stuff in the article was nothing revolutionary. It wasn't some you know, radical, crazy article. And I figured out after I reread it a couple of times that what was annoying me was not so much what was being said, but how the author was saying it. The language that is used in health information technology is very different from the language that is used in medical literature. And that language barrier is yet another manifestation of the huge cultural difference between the two communities. When the medical community publishes an article, wants to communicate, when a researcher or a clinician or somebody wants to communicate with their colleagues, they publish an article in a peer-reviewed journal. That's the place to go. If you're not writing in a peer-reviewed journal, or if the stuff that you're creating doesn't survive peer review, then it's probably not worthy of, you know, the potential reader's time. And one of the things that happens as a result of that process, which, by the way, does not exist to any significant degree within the health IT community, but the one of the manifestations of that peer review process is that we use very humble language when we talk about the new stuff that we're doing. For instance, we might say, if we have a study with great-looking data, new treatment works great, we'll say something like, the treatment that we're talking about shows promise. We might use that kind of phraseology. It's worthy of further study. We're going to repeat the experiment with a larger patient sample. Right? Our new treatment or our new diagnostic technique offers a worthy alternative to existing options. It's all very, very humble language. It's all very sort of understated, because that's the way we want to view ourselves, as making changes slowly, as making changes very carefully. We will never, ever say that a new diagnostic technique will revolutionize the treatment of disease X, whatever we're talking about. You're not going to see that kind of language. That kind of language probably wouldn't survive peer review, even if somebody was foolish enough to do it. The only place you might see language like that is in historical perspective, looking back rather than looking forward. For instance, if I got behind a podium at a medical meeting and I said, David, that the operating microscope, the surgical microscope, right, which has been around for about 50 years, since the 1960s, that the operating microscope revolutionized surgery of the ear, the medical community would probably accept that as a valid statement, because I'm looking back, not looking forward, and we got 50 years of historical perspective that demonstrates, yep, operating microscopes have been around. They've been used for more and more things. We use them in the ear. I use them to operate on vocal cords. We use them all over the place. They've survived the test of time. The design hasn't changed very much because it was a good concept from the beginning. And only in unique situations like that, historical perspective, not a research study that's looking forward, making predictions, only in historical perspective would you see that kind of language being used. That's a sharp contrast to the health information technology community, in which you see quite the opposite, right? You see these things called white papers, right? And the term white paper kind of implies that it's objective, it implies that it's scientific, it implies that paper somehow has value because it's a white paper, I guess because white is a nice sort of sterile description of a paper. But the bottom line is that a white paper is not peer-reviewed. In the health information technology community, a white paper is likely to be published by an IT vendor, and it's sort of disguised as objective information. And the language that you see in there is totally different. So when we get into the next segment, I'm going to talk about some of the crazy language constructs that is used in the health IT literature, including the one term that annoys me the most: disruptive technology. See you in the next segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs.com. docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org, and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock for Medicine on Call. On Medicine on Call, we talk about more than medicine. It's about how to take control of your mind, body, and spirit.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I've got David Moxley here with me in the studio running the board. Thank you for joining us this morning. We are delighted to have you here. Today's topic is the language that health information technology vendors, experts, the health information technology, the language that they use, the language that community uses to communicate its ideas, and how ineffective that language is in communicating with its target audience, which I assume is us, the physicians, and the patients who use or would use information technology. We're talking about the huge differences in language between the medical community and the health information technology community. So on we go. I did a literature search the other day. I've got a patient who has got an unusual problem that we are going to try and fix. But because this was something relatively new, I was going to go to the literature and look up how to do what it is that I wanted to do. It was actually a Botox treatment for something unusual following a head and neck surgery where when they eat, they get a little sweating on the side of their cheek. It's called Fry syndrome, and I'm not going to go into how that works or why it works, but the bottom line is that you can do a Botox treatment on the cheek and stop the sweating. What I didn't have was a protocol on exactly how to do it. So what do? We go to the literature and find somebody who does this stuff and has published the results and try to learn that way. So this particular article I found was probably published about 10 years ago, and it described a protocol for mapping the cheek, where you're going to find where the sweating is going on, and how you use Botox to fix it. And they had a series of 43 patients. And the results, by the standards usually applied to a paper like this, were out of the park home run. Out of 43 patients, all 43 had significant relief from their problem, and there were virtually no side effects. Any of the side effects that you would theoretically worried about didn't happen. So this is an out-of-the-park home run. 43 patients, all 43 got better, and it lasted a long time. And, you know, if there was any results that you might be tempted to call, you know, outstanding, revolutionary, that kind of thing, this would be it. But you know what the author said? They said the treatment appears to be safe and effective. That's all they said. There was no over-the-top language. There was no crazy stuff. In sharp contrast to a white paper that I found off the mHealth News website, Mobile Health News, which is actually a very good website. I downloaded what was labeled as a white paper. And I guess that term is supposed to confer some objectivity, some neutrality, some validity, I suppose. So you read this paper. It's about using mobile devices to access your electronic medical record system, which is not news to us. We do this all the time. But the quotes from the people involved were the usual sort of over-the-top language that you see in the health information technology literature. We're looking for the ultimate value in managing care. We're talking about enabling, quote, seamless clinical workflow. Here's another quote. Studies over time will likely confirm the positive impact EMRs have on improving care. Our results are overwhelmingly positive. Right? You don't see that language in medical literature, but you see it all over the place in health IT literature. Even the things that are failures are overstated. Right? In medicine, we might talk about learning from our mistakes. That might be what we say. That, you know, as we accumulate experience, we accumulate wisdom and judgment, and we learn from our mistakes. That would be how we would describe things that we try that don't work. in health information technology. There's a recent article that talks about the epic fails in mHealth, right? They have to borrow from pop culture and call what they're doing an epic fail. So even in failure, their language is over the top. But out of all those quotes I just gave you, right, overwhelmingly positive, ultimate value, all that kind of thing, there is one particular phrase, one particular concept that bugs me the most. And that is the core topic of today's show. And that is the term disruptive. Disruptive technology, disruptive innovation. The IT community, both inside health IT and the IT community in general, is enamored, one might even say obsessed, with the concept of disruptive technology. And there's videos all over the place, you know, how do you become a disruptor, right? Because you have to disrupt or be disrupted. That's the vernacular, that's the language. So you do a little research, you learn a few things. It turns out that the concept of disruptive innovation comes from a book that was published in 1997 by a Harvard Business School graduate, one Clayton M. Christensen. That's his name, Clayton Christensen. And he describes in this book called The Innovator's Dilemma that the problem with well-established companies that have well-established products is that they continue to make decisions that support their well-established products and that ultimately they fail to recognize that even the most established of products has a finite lifespan in the marketplace, and that eventually one or more startup companies is going to come along with a completely new technology that is going to render their well-established product obsolete. And the image that they use is like missing a flight. Okay, the concept of disruptive innovation is not like missing a flight. When you miss a flight, you know that the airplane's there. You know the airplane's been invented. You know it flies, and you know it's a good mode of transportation. You're trying to catch your flight, and because you don't make good decisions, you miss your flight. That is not disruptive innovation. Disruptive innovation is where you don't even know there's such a thing as an airplane, and you stumble onto the airport runway thinking it's a parking lot, and the airplane runs over you as it takes off. That's what happens to big companies with well-established products in an environment of disruptive innovation. The best example that is offered, because none of the other examples are any good, there's one example that's good, and that is back in the 80s, actually early 80s, when personal computers were coming on the scene, mainly from Apple, right? The PC hadn't come along yet. But it was Apple and Steve Jobs, of course, who first introduced the concept of a computer that is small enough and cheap enough that a consumer can actually buy. That's his idea. And before that came along, there were mainframe computers, and there were these things called mini computers sold by companies like Data General and stuff. They were about $50,000, $60,000 computers. They were about as big as a refrigerator or two or three refrigerators. And so the idea was that the disruptive innovation was stop selling computers to businesses, start selling them to individuals. That was the disruptive innovation concept. And that's a good example. You know, that's even like, have you ever heard of a book called Blue Ocean Strategy, David? Well, yeah, the idea is, there are red oceans and blue oceans, right? In this particular example, the red ocean is mainframe computer sales where there were lots of people competing and there's lots of blood in the water, so it's a red ocean. The blue ocean is consumers that never bought computers before but would if you gave them something that was cheap enough that showed value. So that is probably a very good example of disruptive innovation. The rest of his examples aren't so good. One of them has to do with the disk drives that went into these mini computers or mainframe computers. The very first disk drive was a 18-inch disk, foot and a half, and it went into a drive unit that weighed about 2,000 pounds. And gradually, these things, through what Christensen calls disruptive innovation, I think incorrectly, that these companies, upstart companies, would come up with a smaller drive that held more information, and the upstart company would destroy the bigger company because its product was better. That's not disruptive innovation, that's progress. Overall, you look back at it, the drives gradually got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, from an 18-inch one-ton unit to a 2-ounce thumb drive like we've got today that, you know, anybody can buy for $2 at Target. That's gradual. That's evolution, that's not revolution. And I remember those big disk drives, David. That was my very first summer job as a teenager, was writing computer code for a company that had one of these mini computers. And yeah, the drives, they were huge, and they held a whopping 4 megabytes of information, like nothing, like you know a chip on your thumbnail holds more than that now. And there were other examples in Christensen's book that talked about earth-moving equipment, talked about discount stores versus department stores. And ironically, Christensen tried to make some more money for himself, apparently by starting an investment fund called the Disruptive Growth Fund. And ironically, the Disruptive Growth Fund lasted less than a year before it went belly up. And that's a very, very important thing to understand, because the theory of disruptive innovation is only good for describing the past. It's only good for describing what's already happened. It is not good for figuring out the future. Because in any field, there are the established players, and then there's a million startup companies attacking those established players, and you have no idea which of those startup companies is going to deliver the technology that succeeds the existing technology. So there's no way that disruptive innovation actually works to sell products for the future, which is what Health IT is trying to do. And the concept simply doesn't work. The way they try and make it work is by inciting panic, right? If you're going to use disruptive innovation to sell products, to predict the future, the theory then depends on panic in your customer base. So the idea is, it's going to happen. It's going to happen, David. It's going to happen tomorrow. You better buy the product today, because if you don't, somebody else will. And that person's going to run you into the ground because they've got the latest and greatest and you don't. And that kind of fear-based, panic-based thought process, propaganda, if you will, assumes that just because something is new, it's better, right? It's good simply because it's new. Doesn't matter if it works. Doesn't matter if it's better than what succeeds it. All that matters is that it's replacing something, that it's new. And that simply doesn't work. And the really crazy thing is that in healthcare information technology, the concept gets perverted even further, right? Because consider the computer paradigm, right? You had big computer companies making big computers. You had upstart companies like Apple making little computers for consumers. The customer was nowhere inside that battle. In fact, the customer was the one that was going to decide that battle based on what products they buy. There was no antagonism aimed at the customer. The antagonism was vendor versus vendor, product creator versus product creator. In healthcare, that's not the case. In healthcare, and in healthcare information technology, thanks mostly to meaningful use and the unholy alliance between the health information technology community and the government, all of the health information technology people don't have to fight each other, because the government's poured gasoline on a fire. People are buying everything. They don't have to fight each other. They're fighting us. They're fighting their customers. And now you don't have vendor versus vendor. You have all the vendors banded together versus the customer. They're directing their antagonism at us, at the healthcare system, and saying, you better buy our products, or someone else will, or we'll use them ourselves and take healthcare, take the practice of medicine from you, doctor. So we have a very drastic perversion of a model that even to begin with isn't very good, but then we have this unique modification to healthcare where the intended customer is the subject of the antagonism that exists between startup companies and vendors in other fields. And that's a really, really bad thing. We're going to talk about some other aspects of disruptive innovation that don't work well with physicians in the next segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. and listen to The Doctor's Lounge, where you get a private insight into the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. Join us Thursday, 8 a.m. every week.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, host of Detailing Addiction on America's Web Radio. Please join us at 4 p.m. on Tuesday afternoons.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We are back once again. This is your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek, in the studio here with David Moxley running the board. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. We are talking today about language barriers between health information technology vendors, experts, consultants, and other various and sundry people who call themselves experts in health information technology and the medical provider community. They speak very different languages. They use a concept called disruptive innovation, which they think is a good thing. The health information technology community is enamored with the idea, perhaps even obsessed with the idea. The bottom line, though, is when you apply this to health information technology products, as we discussed in the last segment, the concept falls flat on its face because it is a culture built on fear. Disruptive innovation is a culture, is a propaganda machine built on fear and panic that says you better buy it right now because if you don't, you're going to be left behind. You got to do it today because by Monday it'll be too late. This segment we're going to talk about another reason why disruptive technology simply doesn't resonate well with physicians. And it has to do with the fact that if you talk to a doctor about the concept of disruption, it's not going to be received well. Why is that? That's because in our training as physicians, starting even before medical school, starting with your pre-med courses in biology, even going back to your high school science courses, we are taught that the state of health inside a human body involves the concept of homeostasis, right? Big fancy word. Maybe some of you remember it, some of you don't. The concept in simple terms is that inside your body is a steady state. Regarding just about everything that's going on, you have a steady state with body temperature, you have a steady state with your blood sugar level, you have a steady state with your blood pressure, you have a steady state with blood flow to vital organs like the heart and the brain. We are taught that health, that good stuff, is involving a steady state. And our body does very active things to maintain a steady state, right? You go outside in cold weather, what happens? You get goosebumps, you shiver, your fingertips get cold. Why? Your body is doing things to keep your insides warm, right? Rerouting blood flow from your fingers and your toes into your core, getting goosebumps, raise some muscle activity, generate some heat, so does, you know, shivering does the same thing. Right? Flip that over. If you go out into hot weather, what happens? You sweat. What happens when you sweat? Water evaporates off your skin. You get cooling. Keeps your body temperature down where it's supposed to be. So we spend a long time, years, in basic physiology courses learning all the ways that the body maintains its health by maintaining a steady state. Then we learn about disease. What happens in disease? Disruption. Right? If you're diabetic, your blood sugars are no longer stable. Your blood sugars are disrupted. Usually they're too high. Sometimes they're too low. But with a high blood sugar, all sorts of other dominoes fall. That disruption causes lots of bad things to happen. It causes your eyes to deteriorate. It causes your nerves to deteriorate. It causes your blood vessels to deteriorate, right? Coronary artery disease, blockages in your arteries happen much faster if you're diabetic. So the disruption in blood sugar causes lots of bad things to happen, which destroys your quality of life, shortens your lifespan, unless you control it. How do you control it? By maintaining a steady state with treatment. Right? There's all sorts of other examples. We could use up the rest of the hour talking about these things. In my world, right, one of the things I do, among many, is treat tumors in the head and neck, tumors in the throat. Right? If a tumor grows in the throat, what happens? Your ability to breathe is disrupted. Your ability to talk is disrupted. Your ability to swallow is disrupted. What ultimately happens? Well, often it's fatal. Why? Because of disruption. And we can keep going, right? Coronary artery disease, the flow of blood to the heart is disrupted. When you have a stroke, the flow of blood to the brain is disrupted. So you get the picture? Steady state is good. Disruption is bad. Any change that does happen in the human body, if it's going to be healthy, change has to occur slowly. Right? Talk about weight loss, right? What's the healthiest form of weight loss? Slow weight loss, no more than a pound a week. You want a fad diet that gets rid of weight quickly? Sure, you can find one. How do they make you lose weight quickly? Dehydration. That's a false. Right? Laxatives, right? Reduce the volume in your colon. You can lose a few pounds very quickly that way. It's not real weight loss, but it looks good on the scale, but it's not healthy. So, David, when the provider community is approached by the health information technology community with a technology that's described as disruptive, right? What have doctors been taught for 10, 15 years of training about disruption? It's bad. It's not a good thing. So we don't react well to the concept of disruptive technology because we associate disruption with disease. And in the case of health information technology, we've pretty much been proven right. Right? We've certainly disrupted the healthcare system. We've gone from 4% of providers using EMR in 2008 to, gosh darn near, 70% of providers, 75% of providers now using EMR in 2014. We've certainly disrupted things. Have we made things better? No, we haven't. Right? Because most of those doctors that were coerced into EMR, we've talked about the statistics before, I'm not going to belabor them too much, but the bottom line is that most of the doctors that implemented EMR as a result of meaningful use are pissed off. They don't like their products. They don't like their systems. They're convinced that it's made patient care worse, not better. It's made efficiency worse, not better. And so, you know, it's like the fad weight loss thing. It looks good on paper. Scale shows less numbers, right? The Office of the National Coordinator of Health Information Technology in Washington loves those numbers. Yes, we've got 750,000 doctors on EMR. Isn't that wonderful? Well, if all you care about is the number, yeah, I guess that's pretty good. But just like the weight loss thing, I don't think it's going to stick, right? Meaningful use is running out of steam. It's running out of money. It's unlikely to be re-upped by the incoming Congress, so we'll see what happens. But the bottom line is it hasn't been a very good thing. And it's not that doctors are opposed to change, right? If we do change slowly and we do change deliberately, we do it well, right? We're often accused by the health information technology community of being Luddites, that things that we've established in our field for a long time, we will never, ever, ever change because we are old dogs that can't learn new tricks. And I'm here to tell you that's just not true. There are lots of things in our field, at least, that we have changed that have been unchanged for decades, and all of a sudden we've changed them. I'll give you two examples. The first is the use of Tylenol, right? Tylenol has been a totally uncontroversial drug until that whole cyanide thing back in the 70s was the last time Tylenol really hit the news. Other than that, it's a very safe, uncontroversial drug that people really didn't worry about very much until within the last couple of years we figured out that the numbers that we accepted as a maximum acceptable dose of Tylenol were too high, right? We used to tell people you can take two extra strength Tylenol every 6 hours. That's four times a day. That's 4,000 milligrams or 4 grams of Tylenol. We recently figured out as a medical community that's too much. So we changed the standards. Now all the medicines have been changed, right? Medicines that used to have 5 milligrams of hydrocodone and 500 milligrams of Tylenol for postoperative pain now only have 325 milligrams of Tylenol, and we're very, very compulsive about keeping that Tylenol dose down and telling patients that, you know, for your post-surgical pain, that Lortab, that Norco that's got Tylenol and hydrocodone in it, it's the Tylenol that's the more hazardous drug than the narcotic. So we do change things that have been well established. Second example has to do with the narcotics themselves and postoperative pain control for tonsillectomy in children. Right? We figured out with recent data that the accepted levels of narcotic for kids in pain control and tonsillectomy was not safe. and that we were causing respiratory depression and some near misses. And so we've brought down that number. So the bottom line is we will change anything and with how we do what we do if presented with the right evidence to do it. We're not Luddites. We're not old dogs that can't learn new tricks. But in the case of health information technology, no one's presented us with data that makes the whole industry want to change. We only change because the law has incentives and penalties in it. And, you know, there's no question if you put a big enough carrot in front of the mule and a big enough stick behind him, the mule will move even if it's straight towards the edge of a cliff, which in the case of health information technology is a very distinct possibility. We're going to talk in a minute here about our experience at Ear, Nose, and Throat of Georgia. You know, and again, it may surprise you to learn with all the HIT and EMR bashing that I do that our practice has had electronic medical records for 10 years, and I think we've done pretty well. I'm not saying it's great and it's perfect. Certainly it has its problems and its issues and frustrations, but almost 10 years later, we're still going strong with it, and I think we're doing, you know, much better than most practices. We implemented it before meaningful use forced us to do it. We knew up front that we would have to create our own value and our own return on investment, and I think we've been fairly successful in doing that. You know, after we signed our contract with our EMR provider in 2004, you know, we avoided disruptive innovation. Right, we thought that disruption was about the worst thing you could do, because the standard of practice back then for implementing an EMR was Friday at 5 p.m. was the last time you would use paper records. When you walk in the following Monday at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, all the paper records are gone. You have a computer terminal in every exam room, and you flip the switch, all or nothing. That was the standard of practice back then for implementing EMRs. We looked at that and said, that's hogwash. Why? Because it's disruptive. It's too disruptive. And, you know, you create chaos in a doctor's office trying to do things that way. So we went to the opposite extreme. We avoided disruption. We avoided disruptive innovation. We did things by evolution, not revolution. And so we started off just using the practice management side of this product, right? Because there was a back-end product and a clinical side to it, right? The practice management side, for those of you unfamiliar with it, is the billing, the collections, the, you know, putting in of ICD-9 and CPT codes and that kind of thing to submit claims to insurers. That sort of financial side of it, the doctors don't really touch that side. But we let the practice management side operate first for an entire year so that everybody could get used to that piece before we introduced the far more radical piece, which was the EMR side. And when we did that, we did it very, very slowly. It took us over a year to get 20 doctors in 15 offices up and running. We did it one doctor at a time, one practice at a time, and we left the paper charts in place, right, which was a completely contrarian approach at that time. We left the paper charts in place as a lifeboat, so if a doc starts using EMR and they get panicky, they don't like it, whatever, there's an issue, go back to paper. Let them live with paper for a while. Let's go back to the drawing board. Let's figure out what the problem is with this doctor, this office, whatever, and solve those problems slowly and carefully. How are we doing on time? Are we coming up on the end, or we got about, what, 2 minutes? About a half a minute. Okay. So as we'll discuss in the next segment, how we broke the process of EMR implementation down into non-disruptive steps and totally avoided this concept of disruptive innovation. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back for the final segment of the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you very much for joining us this morning and hanging around till segment four. We got plenty left to talk about here. We got David on the board. We got coffee that's hot. And we're going to get through this last segment and give you some more good stuff to think about. At the end of the last segment, we were talking about how at our practice, Ear, Nose, and Throat of Georgia, that our implementation of electronic medical records nearly 10 years ago, we did as much as we could to avoid the concept of disruptive innovation. We did not want to disrupt things because we know from our training in medicine that when you disrupt things, you have a very high risk of something going wrong, something going bad. And in medicine, we simply don't have a tolerance for those sorts of mistakes. Right? Remember the basic structure of disruptive innovation as described by its inventor, Christensen, who wrote a book called The Innovator's Dilemma, who said that you have a startup company, you have a group of startup companies that are attacking, like piranhas, the establishment that has older technology, established technology, also by no accident proven technology. But what they don't tell you is that of all these dozens of startups that are sort of nipping at the establishment like piranhas, most of them don't have the correct technology. Most of them don't survive. And in the paradigm of disruptive innovation, as originally described, that's okay. Right? Failure is a part of the disruptive innovation process. Problem is, in medicine, we can't tolerate mistakes. We can't tolerate failures. When mistakes happen, people die or people get hurt, right? And we have an example of that, which I've talked about before. I'm going to bring up again in a slightly different context. So when we implemented electronic medical records nearly 10 years ago, we avoided disruption. We avoided disruptive innovation. We chose evolution rather than revolution. And it was a very, very tricky business at the time because when we formally announced that EMR was a done deal, we were going to get it, we had staff that quit. We had staff that said, oh, you guys do an EMR? I'm done. Here's my two-week notice. Not doing it. And some of those folks we could not talk down from the ledge. We had other folks, some of our most valuable employees, who were scared to death of working with a computer. Some of them, our most valuable, you know, greatest, most wonderful employees have been around for 20 years. And we took great pains to sit those folks down and say, look, we are not going to accept a situation where we serve the machines. The machines are going to serve us. And there is no way that we are going to fire you because you can't handle the computer. We will give you as much time as you need. You know, the skills that you bring to our patients are invaluable. And we're not going to let something as stupid as a darn EMR and computer get in the way of how you do what you do, which is so special and so important to us. So we had to take some very strong steps to avoid losing some very valuable people, and we didn't save everyone. But we had to make it clear, you know, where we stood with technology and where the pecking order was of human beings versus technology. And so when we got docs and staff involved in this EMR, we did very incremental steps. We started off with something called a single user training module, which was a disc you could load onto your own laptop, take it home. It was our EMR system, but it was running independently on your computer, and it had fake doctors, fake patients, and you could just kind of surf around. You could practice doing a prescription. You could practice doing a note with fake doctors, fake patients. None of it counted. You get comfortable with that. And then the next step is we take you to our customized EMR training module with the software I was working on, the templates and stuff that I was writing. So now you did the EMR single user training with generic templates, fake doctors, fake patients, to our custom templates that I was working on. And you take as much time as you want to tinker and get comfortable. Once that was done over the course of several weeks, then we let you get on the real EMR, and put in notes for real patients. But the key is we didn't do it all at once. We said, okay, you're going to do the last patient of the day. So what are you seeing? 20 patients, 25 patients, 30 patients, whatever it is in a day, which is what we see, believe it or not. We're not totally happy with that, but you know, we have to see a large volume of patients in the modern era of low reimbursements and managed care. We got to see a lot of people. But we do it with the last patient of the day. So you finish 29 patients, you got your last patient of the day, you're going to do that patient on EMR. The waiting room is empty. Nobody else is waiting. You go in, you see that patient the way you always do, and then you go back and create your note in the EMR. One patient at a time. Now you get comfortable with that, we'll do the last two patients of the day. Maybe then the last three, then the last four or five. And this is a slow process. That's why it took us over a year to get 20 docs and 15 offices and all the supportive staff up and running with EMR. And even that was only to generate the note. At that point in 2004, 2005, there was no electronic prescriptions. There was no charge capture or coding inside the EMR the way we have it today. There was no automated links to the imaging facilities and the labs and that kind of stuff. It was just make the note. We were using the EMR at that point as nothing but an expensive word processor. That was our intermediate step. The idea was go slow. And even now, even 10 years later, David, we're still making incremental changes and incremental improvements to the system as we get better and better at it ourselves, as the documentation requirements change. People want to see different things in the notes for compliance sake, for billing sake. What do the insurers want to see? What does CMS want to see for Medicare patients? We continue to make slow, incremental changes to the templates, to the way that we do things, but nothing revolutionary. It all happens slowly. We get people on board, one doc at a time, one office at a time. We continue to use that approach. We continue to educate. We continue to upgrade slowly, right? I don't even like the word innovate anymore because it implies some sort of radical change that simply, you know, does not work in the medical environment. It might be fine for the automotive industry. It might be fine for the airline industry, fine for the banking industry, and even floppy disk drives, like Christensen talks about in the book, or earth movers, or department stores. That might be just fine, right? In the book Blue Ocean Strategy that I mentioned before, there were some great examples with what is it? What's that Australian wine? Yellowtail. That's it. Yellowtail wine was a great example of Blue Ocean Strategy, where they decided to not market wine to wine drinkers anymore, but to market it to beer drinkers and expand the market. Go where nobody's selling wine. That's a Blue Ocean Strategy. You want to do radical stuff with wine. You want to do radical stuff with Cirque du Soleil, which was another example in Blue Ocean Strategy. Fine. But in healthcare, that doesn't work. In healthcare, if you choose the wrong technology, or you don't have the experience, because nobody does, the experience to properly implement and safely implement health information technology, people get hurt. People die. And we have an example of this, right? It was squashed by Epic because Epic has got lots of power, lots of money, lots of political connections, and a very belligerent CEO that squashed the story. But remember the story of the first Ebola patient who came to a hospital in Dallas, and their travel history was entered into the EMR by a data entry person of some kind, but failed to reach the provider. And so the wrong decision was made. The patient was sent home because the travel history wasn't known to the decision makers, and there was a tragedy. The problem is not interoperability, like people like to talk about. This all happened inside one system. Right, so all this stuff that the CEO of Athena Health said about, oh, this Dallas tragedy is a terrible example of how we need interoperability between systems. No, that's wrong. This was not an interoperability problem. This was a failure of the core technology. This was a failure of the IT community's product to live up to its claim, doctor, that we're going to put great products in front of you. We're going to offer you clinical decision support, which means we're going to put the right information in front of you at the right time. I can't tell you the number of times I have read that claim in health information technology literature. And yet here it is, the leading vendor, the highest market share of any single vendor is Epic, and their product failed to deliver on what their claim was. And as a result, we had a tragedy. That's unacceptable in medicine. And that's what happens when you implement technology too quickly, right? We now have 750,000 unhappy physicians, for the most part, who have been forced to implement EMR against their better judgment, and we have them running crappy EMR products on networks. And this gets to what we were talking about between the break, David. David was asking about the safety of networks and, you know, if the North Koreans can hack into Sony and Eastern European hackers can hack into, you know, Home Depot or Target or any of these other things, how safe is health information technology? Right now, probably the only safety is in the fact that these databases are fragmented and, you know, none of them are as big as a Sony or a Walmart or a Target or a Home Depot or these, you know, places that have been successfully hacked. But, you know, in this day and age, the hackers are walking into our databases at will. And this is in spite of the fact, I mean, I presume that Sony has the resources to employ lots of, you know, information technology experts who were charged with the task of making their network safe, and yet there seems to be no deterrent. I mean, you know, putting somebody's health information on a network is like, you know, parking your Corvette out at the far end of the parking lot with the door unlocked and the keys in the ignition. I mean, that's how it feels. And you know, even in our own practice, I mean, we have pursued the concept of a fully secured network like some kind of holy grail. We've invested thousands of man hours, hundreds of thousands of dollars, dozens of health IT experts, and we're making progress.
But once that goes out of your office to the hospital,
or even, it's not even to the hospital, David. We have a network of servers. It's something called a server farm, which is a protected thing with power and internet access and, you know, grounding protection and all that kind of stuff. But
all I'm saying is once it leaves your office, your system, then the security may be
gone. The security, you have no control over the security. I mean, right. And that's where when you start talking about interoperability, I mean, we can't even handle security. The IT community can't even handle security when you're talking about silos, when you're talking about individual ones, right? Because right now, you know, there's not a lot of ways for us to communicate directly with a hospital or hospitals to communicate directly with each other. And we have politicians bemoaning it. We have experts bemoaning this lack of interoperability. Not only is that not the biggest problem, but it's not the scariest one either. I mean, if we were to force interoperability the way we force the rest of meaningful use, which is part of what Stage 2 does, we're going to make the security problem worse. We're going to do all these hookups between big systems and create another area of vulnerability that hackers are going to be able to exploit. And right now, I mean, the last 12 months has offered, I'm going to borrow from the health IT vernacular, overwhelming evidence that IT does not have its act together regarding security. I mean, they might in a lab, right? They might take their own products and stick them in a testing lab and, you know, in their own little controlled environment, it's hack-proof. But clearly in the real world, the stuff's not hack-proof. And so we have a situation where we've forced three-quarters of the medical community to adopt technology that lacks enough security. I mean, it's a disaster in the making. Who's going to be next? Is it going to be a healthcare entity? Is it going to be CMS? We don't know. Hope it's not us. Anyhow, we're at the end of the hour. Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to go back to the office, see patients, and stomp out death and disease and keep living the dream, David. Anyhow, have a good holiday, David. You all out there have a good holiday. And we will see you back first of the year. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.